From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The FDA has halted trials of a procedure known as fecal transplants. It's pretty much what it sounds like. Fecal matter from one person is given to another person as a pill or through a feeding tube. The idea is that the microbes from a healthy person's gut could help treat or cure another person's health problems. After all, research in the past few years has shown that our bacteria, known as our microbiome, control way more than just metabolism. They can influence our immune system and even our brains. So the obvious next step is to start tinkering with those gut bacteria, and fecal transplants are one way to do that. The procedure has shown a lot of promise for treating an intestinal infection called C. difficile, but now one person has died and another is ill after they received fecal transplants from someone carrying an antibiotic-resistant strain of E. coli. Kjersti Aagaard is the Henry and Emma Meyer Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Baylor College of Medicine, and she recently published an opinion piece in Nature Medicine where she and colleague Dr. Elizabeth Homan of Harvard describe the need for caution and better regulation of fecal transplants. Kjersti, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
I hate to ask this, but are you surprised by the news of the past week, the death of a patient and the suspension of fecal transplant trials?
So while I wish I could say no, I think while we urged exercising caution, I think that none of us imagined that death was ultimately in the profile. However, you know, as we all hearken back to our own experiences in medicine over the years, perhaps we shouldn't have been surprised. I remember during my own training when patients with, for example, HIV and fulminant AIDS would actually die of C. difficile infections. And so I think this is a potent reminder of what things once were. Are we entirely surprised? No. Are we saddened and horrified by this outcome? Yes.
Well, the FDA is calling for better screening of donor fecal matter to avoid this kind of thing in the future. And obviously, screening for antibiotic-resistant bacteria should be possible, but it raises a bigger question. I mean, do we even know what else we should be screening for?
No, I don't think we do. And that was really what Elizabeth and I were bringing forward in the opinion paper that we wrote for Nature Medicine. There's the pathogens that we can certainly imagine. We can widen the scope of what we screen for, things that we know are dangerous. But then there's the things we don't really know how and what to screen for. And those may be equally, if not greater, problematic over time.
You mentioned in your opinion piece the fact that we've been learning that the composition of your gut bacteria can determine long-term risk for things like depression or chemotherapy sensitivity if you develop cancer, for that matter, developing cancer. And you can't screen for that risk if that person hasn't developed any of those conditions yet, you know, in the donor, I mean.
That's exactly correct. I think there are a couple of different analogies that we can maybe use to wrap our heads around this. One is when we're doing something as crude as a fecal microbiota transplant, we're quite literally taking the complete microbial ecology from one human volunteer and putting it into another. That's like taking a landscape with all of its niches and valleys and mountains and lakes and moving it to a whole nother site. What is retained within that complex ecologic landscape, we don't entirely know. And indeed, it could be diseases that haven't yet appeared. When we think about these phenotypes that we could be transferring, or these profiles, we don't entirely know how to check, measure, and understand what risk we are conferring.
Well, and to continue using your analogy of transferring an entire landscape, I mean, that is in part the allure, because we don't necessarily know which parts or whether it's the whole that might confer these risks or the benefits. But this case seems to really highlight how site-specific those risks or benefits might be. I mean, this donor was presumably seeming healthy, was not bothered by the antibiotic-resistant E. coli.
Correct.
But it became a huge problem, a fatal problem for one of the people to whom that fecal matter was transferred.
Exactly, exactly. So if we're limiting these fecal transplants at this point to people who have known illness, we can estimate what's the benefit and what's the risk. And so in somebody who has something like Clostridium difficile that has failed recurrent medical treatment, there may be some potential benefit. That ability to discern out those risks both have to do with how we measure that donor's phenotype, i.e., is that person healthy? But also, we have to be able to measure what genes could be harbored in that donor's microbiome that could turn around and confer risk or different disease on the recipient.
And when you say different genes, you mean in the bacteria, not human genes.
Correct. So bacteria like us harbor their own genetic repertoire. So we need to think about with the donor, how do we both phenotype and genotype screen that fecal transplant that would be used?
Kjersti Agard, there's been a lot of excitement about not just fecal transplants, but in general, trying to figure out how to potentially manipulate the bacteria that live in and on us to take advantage of the benefits that they can confer and limit the risks. I mean, it doesn't sound like you're saying we should abandon this line of research and eventually treatment, but are we really ready to be doing fecal transplants yet? Do we know enough?
So I think that that's the really laden question. And while we can certainly have a discussion about that in academic circles and regulatory circles, the so-called ivory tower, part of the folks that we need to bring into this discussion are patients and the public at large. What measure of risk are people willing to incur in order to have a disease trajectory reversed? And it is incumbent upon us to explain to patients what we don't yet know. We have hints that the microbiome, as you mentioned, may be very important in either modifying or determining certain behaviors or certain mental health disorders. How do we explain that to patients? And are they willing to accept that level of risk in doing a transplant? Now, none of us, I think, believe that fecal transplant is going to be the be-all, end-all. Right now, this is, again, transferring a whole community ecology from one individual to the next. Are we going to be able, over time, to parse this down and say, well, it turns out we don't need to transfer somebody's stool. Maybe we can just pick the 10 bacteria that are really missing in an individual, cultivate those in a lab in a little bit more of a safe manner, and then turn around and transfer those. That may be where this research is heading. Right now, there's obviously a lot of risk, and how we decide whether that risk is acceptable has to do with both the scientific and medical community, the regulatory community, and the patients and the public at large.
Well, Kjersti Agard, and you talking about moving toward being able to simply give someone like a medicine instead of a chemical to give them specific bacteria, that raises a whole other regulatory ball of wax, which is, what even are these? Are these medicines? Are they procedures? Are they supplements? How do we even start to regulate them appropriately?
So that becomes, again, a really kind of confusing arena where if we're going to make a health claim, i.e. we're treating a disease, we're attempting to cure a disease, then that falls under one regulatory capacity within the FDA. Some people look at these as more wellness, such as nutrition. That falls under a completely different, largely unregulated or differently regulated. But when you don't have that degree of regulation, not only are you missing some of the oversight of it, but how do you decide whether or not One strain of bacteria produced by one company will have the same very predictable results as another. And that's certainly something that's plagued the vitamin and nutrition industry for a long time, of being able to replicate and reproduce those results in a very reliable manner. So both of those still have the need for regulatory oversight and assessment of where that risk and benefit is acceptable.
You also have called for a larger role of bodies outside of the traditional FDA regulatory procedure for academic institutions to have review boards involved in looking at studies of these procedures, to have additional ethics committees looking at potential studies or trials. What do you think those kinds of steps could add to the process, and how would they make things safer than a traditional FDA review?
So I think what going into institutional review board constructs and ethics committees help us do is enables us to quantify the risk we don't yet know and put that in terms that everybody can understand easily. When we're kind of going into uncharted waters, where we say, you know what, there's a hint that your bacterial community profile may influence a risk of a disease that we don't see today, but may manifest at 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road, how do we communicate those kind of degrees of unknown risk? And are they things that we should be disclosing to patients? Like, how do we deal with uncertainty in medicine in such an emerging and burgeoning field? This is not a journey that we as scientists and physicians should be taking alone. This is a journey we really need to reach across a large number of spheres in order to understand how we help assess that risk and decide whether it's acceptable or not.
Make the case that we should embark on this journey. I mean, if it is so risky and so difficult to regulate, why bother? How powerful could these kinds of microbiome-based treatments actually be?
So I think they have the potential to be incredibly valuable, and they have the potential that we can tailor them in ways that we can't always tailor, for example, gene therapy that's directed at our own genetic content. So they have the potential for us to give things over limited periods of time to help people recover from a disease and then even re-restore their own microbiomes back to once they were. There's a lot of potential to give a highly tailored therapy. However, how we do that, when we do that, what are some hidden risks and dangers that we don't yet appreciate is where the discomfort lies. The reality of making this all come to fruition is going to require a lot more research, but it needs to be carefully regulated, carefully controlled, carefully explained, and very carefully thought through.
Kjersti Agard is professor and the Henry and Emma Meyer Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Baylor College of Medicine. She recently published an opinion piece in Nature Medicine where she and colleague Dr. Elizabeth Homan of Harvard described the need for caution and better regulation of fecal transplants and other attempts to manipulate our bacteria for health. Kjersti, thanks so much.
Entirely my pleasure. Have a wonderful afternoon.